The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And good morning and welcome to this May 23rd, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. Before we launch off, I wanted to make a quick note about our fund drive, which we finished last week. And special thanks to so many of our listeners who called in to donate. And my guest last week, Mark Sarvis, who donated his signed book to one of our callers. It takes a village to keep us on the air and support college radio, and takes a village to support this show that's been on 20 years this year. So thank you for that. It's never too late to donate. So even though the official drive is over, if you missed out, you can always catch us, kuci.org. But thanks for all you do to support the show. Speaking of 20 years, last month, if you missed any of our podcasts, you can find us on iTunes under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter. I don't know anything about Twitter, but I hear we're on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. Barbara's website, penonfire.com. My website, mariestone.com. You can listen live online at kuci.org. There is no excuse not to listen. So enough of all of that. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. The days when I have the luxury of one author for the entire hour are my very favorites. We get to take a deep dive. And today I have the author in the studio with me, which is extremely rare. So we're not going to have any dropped phone calls or bad connections. And a morning with novelist and short story guru, Richard Bausch. I am hitting the trifecta this morning. Richard Bausch is the author of 12 novels and 8 previous volumes of short stories. He's the recipient of the REA Award for the short story, the Penn Malumet Award, the Guggenheim Fellowship, a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award. I've lost my place in all of these awards. The Dayton Literary Peace Prize for his novel Peace. He's a past chancellor of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, and his work is widely anthologized, including in the Pushcart Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards, Best American Short Stories, New Stories from the South. It goes on and on. He's on the writing faculty at Chapman, just down the road from us at UCI. His latest collection is Living in the Weather of the World. It's published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. It's going to drive our discussion this morning. Richard, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
That's an introduction. I'm exhausted after that introduction so much. So you probably don't know this, but our regular listeners certainly know this, that I am a fanatic for the short story, short fiction form, and I try to champion it whenever I can. So this is an extra special treat, and I'm embarrassingly remiss in not having you on before now. So welcome. I apologize. So before we dive into the book, because we have the luxury of time, I thought I would love to hear sort of about your initial path into writing. You have 12 novels, 9 collections, so I know you've been at this a long while. And I'd just love for you to talk about those early years and decisions to go into writing.
Sure. When I was much younger than what would normally be, what one would say is the time that one starts writing. I was 9 and 10 and 11, like that. There was a thing that my twin brother Bobby and I both had in common, that we seemed to be more attuned. Not, attuned is the wrong word because it sounds self-congratulatory. I mean, we seemed to be more afflicted by worrying about consequences. We could always see a few minutes ahead, and it was always with a sense of foreboding when we were doing whatever, you know, the kind of stuff you do when you're, I mean, I remember once saying to a friend of mine named Bryce, after we'd busted a window one Sunday morning and went running, does the stuff that we're doing, does it ever bother you? Do you ever? And I remember he spit through his teeth and said, nope. And I knew then that there's something strangely not like everybody else. Again, I don't mean that in a self-congratulatory way. I thought it was a failing. I became interested in the priesthood, and I memorized all these prayers. And it wasn't until I was maybe 20, 21, that I began to realize that what I really loved was the words. And I had started reading then, when I was 18, I was reading the Church Fathers and, you know, St. Francis de Sales and Aquinas. I went through Aquinas. It seems so reasonable to look at those propositions about the existence of God and all that. And I read St. Ignatius Loyola and the Spiritual Exercises and Duns Scotus. I was just, you know, I was just buried in all of this stuff. And Thomas Merton. Mm-hmm. And then I started reading Merton's poems and got into other poems and started to scribble what I thought might be poems. I was imitating Walt Whitman.
How old were you?
18, mm-hmm. 19. Mm-hmm. And then when Kennedy got killed, that was when I was 18. Kennedy got killed. I read that he had read War and Peace, and I was going to pick up the torch, you know, when I got to the right age. And I was going to get into politics and all that stuff. And I bought War and Peace and this drugstore, the Rosemary Edmonds translation, which I still love. And I've since read it. I've read War and Peace 5 times now. And I'm about to start it again with my friend Alan Weyer, who says he's never read it, and he's going to start it this summer. And I said, I'll read it with you. It's fun to read it with a friend, especially somebody brilliant and a great writer like Mr. Weyer. Then I just sort of fell into it. I remember a teacher saying to me, you're a writer. And it stunned me. I mean, the whole time I was in the Air Force, I was writing song lyrics and occasionally, you know, writing a story. And I remember I wonder if I'm a writer the way some kids wonder if they're adopted. It wasn't as if I would choose it. It was as if, I wonder if this is some aspect of my nature, because I was doing it all the time. And so is Bobby. I mean, you know, Bobby has, my twin brother Robert Bausch has novels and a book of stories. He's a wonderful writer. Mm-hmm. So we're, as far as we know, we're the only identical twin novelists in history, which I think is funny.
It's cool, yeah.
But the whole thing felt kind of accidental to me until, I guess I was 20, I was 26. I mean, I wanted to sing. I was playing guitar and, you know, traveling around and singing. And I saw Peter Taylor. I was at George Mason University. He came there to give a reading. And I remember saying to my wife then, that's what I want to do. I'm going to be a writer in a university. I'm going to write fiction, you know. I'm done writing songs. And, you know, I've written maybe 5 songs since then. Yeah, I wrote dozens of songs, and I would let it be that if I remembered the song, then it was probably worth singing. And so many of them, I couldn't remember them after, you know, a month or 2 months. So, and you know, I'm very limited as a guitar player. I mean, I can sing, but anyway, so that I felt like I thought, I read that Dylan had a novel, and I thought, okay, well, that's how you do it. You have to get famous as a singer-songwriter, then they'll let you write novels.
Right.
So that's how dumb I was at 18, 19.
What were your parents' relationship with this? As they're watching their two sons embark on this journey, are they supportive?
Oh, yeah. It was just, well, that's great. You know, there was no... I remember my father coming and looking over my shoulder saying, what are you writing? I said, poetry. And he said, what's the meter? It doesn't look like you have, the lines look kind of uneven. And I said, well, I'm writing free verse. And he went, oh, well, you ought to learn how to write iambic pentameter before you get around to messing with the free verse. And stuff like that, you know. But they were marvelous storytellers. My mother was an extremely talented artist. I mean, Bobby and I can draw, but nothing like the way she did and could. And she was in another time, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So she raised 6 children and, you know, quit painting and drawing. And my dad wanted to be a sports writer, and he was a storyteller. Boy, it was fun watching him tell stories. I thought that was what everybody's father did until I saw other people's father. So, like that. But they were great in so many ways, but the two most important ways, it seems to me, is they never did the twin thing with Bobby and me. They never dressed us alike or did all that stuff. Mm-hmm. We were always treated separately. Bobby and I were in the Air Force together, and we each got a letter from our mother about every week, and both of the letters were individually addressed to individual things that we were interested in. Mm-hmm. And she would give us news, but it was never the same. It was always, you know, the separate. They were so careful to make sure we were treated as individual people. And I think it's one of the reasons we get along so well now. You know, we're like two pals, you know. Except that this is a pal I can call when I'm anxious and say, you know, I got this this or that problem. I've had a headache for 3 days like that. Oh, that's happened to me before. Oh, good. I can go on, you know.
Right, right.
So.
I haven't read his work, but I want, do you feel like your writing is in conversation with each other? Do you feel the twinness rippling through your work?
Not really. His books are of a more philosophical bent than mine. This is not to say, in fact, the plain fact is his books are also just drop dead funny, and darker than anything I mean, he's way darker than I am, but you're laughing so hard you don't quite notice it till you get toward the end of the book. He wrote the novel that they made Bruce Almighty out of, a novel called Almighty Me. They gave him a lot of money to take it off the market, and then they switched studios and never paid him another penny. He had to sue him. And he had Art Buchwald's lawyer, Buchwald, who successfully sued a studio for Eddie Murphy's film that had been taken from Buchwald. But it got, the guy said finally after years, he said, I'm going to have to start charging you. I can't keep doing it on spec. And Bobby just said, oh, I got a family, the hell with this. I'm not going to spend money. I'm not going to chase after this anymore. I'm working on other stuff. Yeah. So.
Well, let's dive into the short stories, because it's an extraordinary collection. All your collections are extraordinary. I've been a fan of you for a long time. So perhaps we can set the stage for the collection, Living in the World with Living in the Weather of the World. It's 14 stories. They aren't interconnected, although there's kind of this pull around Memphis. As I describe them, they're quietly devastating. After each one, I kind of had to take to my bed for a while. But just talk about the collection, what's been on your mind, kind of where the stories came from a little bit, and then we can dive into some of them.
Okay, I got the title of the book while I was in the middle of writing the story Map Reading that's in there. Mm-hmm. There's a place where a guy says to his half-sister, you know, you live in whatever weather there is where you are. And I thought, well, that's the title, Living in the Weather of the World. And, of course, thematically for me, it's we're all living in the weather of the world, and we all have to. The world's weather is often storming and threatening and even, you know, dangerous. And there seemed to me to be a strain going through the book of, I don't know, catastrophic possibility. A tease about the there's a psychological condition called ANTS, which is automatic negative thought syndrome. And I say, well, my problem is not ANTS, it's ACTS, automatic catastrophic thought syndrome. And that if you're a story writer, that's sort of how you live. I mean, you just, it's finally part of the program. It's what you sign up for if you're going to write stories, because you're living in the imagination and you have to think of things in terms of trouble, because fiction is about trouble and how we face into it and how we live with it. I mean, there are fictions that aren't about that. They're about other kinds of things. And the difference is really what makes the difference between so-called genre fiction or entertainment fiction, mere entertainment, they call it, which I think is a ridiculous thing. Entertainment is honorable and holy. And if you can entertain, more power to you, you know. Just has to do with what your, where your interests are.
Mm-hmm.
All of it, to me, is good. All of it. And I don't mean, I don't say that in a condescending way. I'm saying it as a fan. It's all wonderful. And the fact that people can sit down and write good sentences and make other people feel something, and the fact that people want to feel something for someone else is a beautiful human trait. It's the thing that makes us who we are. And so, but the conflict kind of thing in many of the entertainment novels. I don't like the terminology, but in many of those novels, the conflict is something that can be resolved with some sort of action or actions. For instance, just recently in the film, the Commuter with Liam Neeson, it's mm-hmm. a fun flick, and there's something you got to solve, and he's trying to solve it, and you know, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
But the conflict can be resolved with some sort of action that he has to take. In so-called serious fiction, again, I don't like the, you know, because plenty of serious fiction will make you laugh till you ache. But the difference is that the conflicts that that fiction is about are things that cannot be solved with some action. The way I used to put it with students, I'd say, Rambo's mother just died. Who does he shoot? So that the so-called serious fiction is really about those things we have to make friends with to keep living, that we can't do anything about. We just have to find our way through it. And a lot of times describing that can be upsetting but you hope it's moving and you hope that there's something redemptive in it, that if you don't learn anything else from a piece of fiction like that, you learn that you're not alone, that the things that you struggle with are common to the species, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, all of that is oversimplification, but it's also, I think, true in a lot of ways. But there are writers, as I say, of all the different genres that I find tremendously entertaining and fun to read. And of course, I read a lot of poetry because that's the center of it all, you know.
Yeah.
A good poem can take you so many places. There's a poem of Robinson Jeffers called Cremation. It's short, but it goes like this. It nearly cancels my fear of death, my dearest said, when I think of cremation. To rot in the earth is a loathsome end, but to roar up in flame. Besides, I'm used to it. I've flamed with love or fury so often in my life. No wonder my body is tired. No wonder it is dying. We had great joy of my body. Scatter the ashes. It's like six lines. And it'll get you every time. I'll say to a crowd, I'm going to get you with this poem, and I'll say it, and everybody just, you know, oh, my God.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It's so powerful, you know.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of poetry, a lot of poetry.
You can tell in this collection that you read a lot of poetry.
Oh,
you can tell
you.
The people who have a deep appreciation for poetry, I think, in their writing.
Agree with you 100%. A writer who doesn't read any poetry, you can see it in the prose. And a writer who does, you just feel the music in the prose because they have taken in all that music, you know.
And the rhythm and the cadence. And mm-hmm. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I always think it's interesting, the world the book is born into. And as you mentioned, you know, doom and catastrophe are two words I would describe the book being born into right now. And I was wondering if, you know, kind of as you look across the arc of your work, 21 pieces of work now published, I'm sure there's much more. If you can see the changes in yourself over that time, what you were interested in, or if you see reverberating themes that have been with you since you were a young man.
That's a beautiful question. You know, the thing that's amazing is I can't unthink them. In other words, if I remember myself at 24, the books are all there. Mm-hmm. It's impossible for me to remember what it was like before they were there. And I think it's probably true of us with our children. It's impossible to remember how it was when there weren't these wonderful people that have come into the world. But it's really true. I cannot unthink them at all. I can't recall or bring back the fullest memory of how it was without them. They're all there all the time, which I just find very interesting. But I don't think very often about what it is I have to say to the world. I think probably for a writer of my ilk, that would be a mistake. Because I'm not that smart. So for me, it would be, you know, just feeling my way through and trying to be clear. I mean, that's what I tell students. If you can just do that, try to be clear so that the image you have in your head is the same image in the reader's head through the language, then a lot of stuff will take care of itself. And that's not original with me. James Joyce, of all people, said that. Just be clear, and the good things will happen.
You've talked about it as sleight-of-hand magic. My mm-hmm. husband's a sleight-of-hand magician, so and a photographer. And he gave it, excuse me, he gave a talk about how a good photograph is like sleight-of-hand magic. That you don't, you want to create the effect, but you don't want anybody to see all the behind-the-scenes clutter that goes into creating the effect.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think writing is like that, too.
Absolutely. It sure is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Somebody will say,
that's
well,
the trick.
Yeah. Because somebody will say, this is, you know, is this contrived? And I'll say, you know, about their work. And I'll say, of course it's contrived, but your job is to hide the contrivance so that the reader doesn't see the contrivance. But it's all contrived. It's made up. And, you know, you're trying to figure, well, what happens here? And will they believe it, you know? And is this what really happens? I can't tell you how many times writing a story, something else occurs to me. Mm-hmm. And I realize, yeah, that's where it's really going, you know. I have a story called The Man Who Knew Bell Starr, and there's a place in the story, he says, where he picks up this hitchhiker, this woman, and he says, where are you headed? And she extends her arm and points her thumb down and says, down. And when I'm writing it, I thought she was telling him that she was dying. And later in the story, they stop at this little cafe, and she pulls a pistol out of her bag and aims it at the guy behind the counter and says, let me have what's in that cash register, and shoots the guy in this, my protagonist's presence. I didn't, when it happened, I put it down and went, I've been watching too much television, you know, and I had a bad cold. I went back to bed and worked on another story longhand. And it was maybe 2 weeks later, I was talking to a student of mine in the bar after class, and I said, you know, you got to go with your subconscious, whatever occurs to you to say, you got to go with it. And a voice in my head said, why don't you go home, fool, and follow your own advice. And I went home that night and wrote until sunrise and finished the story. And that's when I learned, you just, you know, put anything down. If you say I was being chased by a gigantic pair of sweat socks, the next line has to do with that, or else, you know, you don't have anything, so you put down the next line and see where it takes you. And each line predicates the next one. And then going through it, you have to try to be convincing and clear and take out everything that doesn't really apply to what you didn't know you were doing until you knew it. And what's left is the story of whatever length. I mean, I have a novel called Rebel Powers that I thought was a 10-page radio story when I started it. It's all expression. You just think in terms of getting the story told however long it takes, you know. And sometimes it takes less time than others. By less time, I mean less space, because I've had short stories take me 5 to 6 years, you know, just working on it over and over and going back and leaving it for a while and then coming back to it and trying to figure out what the heck is wrong with it.
I have a 10-year one.
You do?
Yeah. Took 10 years. And I think it's actually still not done, but I've decided to just let it go.
Yeah, they're never finished, finally. They're just abandoned.
Right, right. We talk a lot about that on the show, the idea that your subconscious is so much smarter than your conscious mind. Mm-hmm. And the more room you give it to run, the more interesting the story and the more surprise. And
absolutely.
I think that's great.
It's absolutely true.
One thing you brought up, one thing I love to do with short story writers, I don't know if you'll indulge me or not, is to take a few of these. You can choose them or I can choose them, and just dissect them and deconstruct them. And we'll go from your very initial thoughts, you know, kind of the first sentences you wrote down about a story, to how the story came to tell you what it was about.
Right.
And, you know, some of the decisions you made in crafting it. I don't know if you want to choose one. One that gave you more trouble than others that makes sense.
Probably. I think probably the longer one, The Liniments of Gratified mm-hmm. Desire. Mm-hmm. When I began the story, I knew it was going to be about a guy who becomes so enamored, a form of, I don't know how to put it really, a form of sexual greed, where he has a fully romantic and lovely relationship with someone who has had to go home to help her mother through rehabilitation for knee surgery. And he's a young man who comes from a good family, a couple of intelligent people. They're both college teachers. College teachers are usually intelligent. I'm not saying they all are, but I shouldn't say that. That's that's unfriendly. I don't mean
say that.
I include myself. That helps. I'm not all that intelligent, but
it's a discussion for another time.
the problem of it began to be, how do I deliver that romance that he had with lust? That it's really the difference between love and lust, and he makes the worst mistake of his life. And you know, the young woman he's painting her is not at all interested in him as a person. And I also was thinking how I might explore the way it feels to be treated as an object, you know, for a man who's supposed to be a man, the way we all think of that and the way the culture thinks of it. Anyway, I had a lot of trouble figuring out how it all, you know, comes about. And I knew it was going to take a long time. And I knew it was going to be pretty close to novella length. Which I love the novella. I mean, you know, Henry James talking about the blessed nouvelle. I just love it. Mm. But they're very, very economically inefficient. I mean, in the sense you say, it'll earn me little profit and less honor, because people really don't like to read long stories. I mean, I think the whole craze for flash fiction has to do with people just, they have so many things they have to do, they can't be bothered to sit there and read for the maybe 2 days it would take to read it. Peter Taylor used to talk about an evening's entertainment. but anyway, that I just had a lot of trouble with it, just line by line. I had difficulty with it. And
where did it start? Did it start with an image? Did it start with him being a painter? Did it?
I think it did start with an image. Her, Sonia, his fiance, coming out of the mist in that window. You know, it started with that. Mm-hmm. And but right away I knew he was going to fall the way he did fall. And I love the end. I love the end. Drove out of his life forever.
Back into the mist.
Yeah. But there's a story in there, too, called We Belong Together.
I want to just go back to that story before we leave it.
Okay.
I love that he's a painter, painting her as an object while she is objectifying him.
Right.
And painting the representation of his, you know, he doesn't love her. He lusts after
he
her.
Lusts
and
after
so he's,
her.
You know, the metaphor is in the paint, in the painting of her.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the work of your subconscious mind or if you wrote the story and you're like, ah, that.
No,
worked
I'm
well.
Just going, ah, now when you say that. Thank you, Marie. That was nice. Yes, I'll take that. This is the thing. I mean, you know, I remember I have a story called What Feels Like the World, and I thought I was writing about the helpless feeling a parent has watching a child go into a school, and you know that 6 hours they're going to be at the mercy of whatever the fates bring, and there's nothing you can do. And I wrote the story, and I was visiting the poet Roland Flint's class at Georgetown, and he was talking, you know, he had the students read the story, he's talking about it, and he said, this story's soaked in grief. And the vaulting horse is a symbol, a thing you can't get over, you know, because she's the only kid in the fifth grade who can't get over the vaulting horse. And her mother's been dead a year from a car accident. And he's trying to, the father is in Oregon somewhere with another wife and other children, and he's trying to raise his granddaughter. And Flint said that this whole story is soaked in grief, and that vaulting horse is a symbol, the thing you can't get over. And I remember thinking, damn, that's good.
That's good. That's smart.
Wow. And it's true. Thing is, we're not entirely, probably for good reasons, we're not entirely in charge of our own consciousness all the time.
For excellent reasons, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
I always think if writers hadn't been writers, they'd be psychotherapists. Because it really is a psychotherapy on your character.
That's a good way to put it, and I'd rather think of it that way. I used to think that I was a writer, and if I hadn't become a writer, I'd probably have been a criminal. There's a thing.
Two sides of the same coin, really.
There's a thing that the writer, Bruce, me and Nate, I'm dyslexic, and my dyslexia manifests itself.
You're dyslexic?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Bruce J. Friedman.
That's great.
Bruce J. Friedman, yeah. Wonderful writer. Hmm. Wrote movies and other things, but he was telling me we were doing this workshop thing up in Toronto, and we're riding in this, they would put us in limousines to take us to the site, and we're riding along, and he said, this is how he talked. Very funny guy. He goes, I used to think, you know, that if I write about psychologists a lot, and if I hadn't become a writer, I might have been a psychologist. And so I told my wife that. I said, you know, if I hadn't been a writer, I might have been a psychologist. And she said, well, there's one problem. And I said, what? And she said, you never listen. And I said, oh, right. I laughed so hard. I almost fell out of the Lincoln the way he said it. Oh, right. A funny man. Wonderful writer.
You have to listen to your characters, though.
Yeah, really.
To your peril. There's, you know, there's such a ribbon of violence through these stories and a ribbon of adultery. And I feel like all violence in some way is like this expression of the id at the expense of another person. And adultery, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, is the same thing, an expression of id at the expense of somebody else. And I don't know. I was just wondering if through the course of this, did the stories teach you something about human nature? Or did you finish some of these and say, I understand something I didn't understand about people before? Or is that not their job?
No. I mean, for me, it's just a... I don't know. I feel like the writer who says, I want to engineer better human beings is a despot before he ever takes up a pen. Mm-hmm. That the real thing is to render life as it is. I mean, I take that from, you know, the father of us all, Mr. Chekhov, mm-hmm. who I still read with great delight over and over. just such astonishing stories. And they just render life. There's a story of his called In the Ravine. It is one of the most corrosively depressing. Oh, my God, is that story a killer. And you read it every time and you feel your soul whitening as you're reading it because it's just searing. But it's so clear. And you take from it a sense that, well, of the relentlessness that suffering can be in life. A picture of it. So, I think I remember when I thought in this first story, it's called Walking Distance. I had this guy, this police officer on a walk, casual clothing, wearing a sweatshirt and jeans with his, you cannot go anywhere unless you have your sidearm with you when you're a police officer. You're always supposed to be carrying it. He's carrying his, going on his morning walk, and he's just had this devastating revelation that his wife isn't happy and wants to leave him. And this fellow walks out of the golf course and pulls a gun on him and tries to rob him. And I'm walking along, and I had an image of him taking out his revolver, and that the gun the guy's holding on him is a sealed barrel. It's fake. And he says, I couldn't even shoot myself, and drops it. And then I saw him walk up almost like a sense of revenge for that kind of cruelty on the part of the guy who's going to rob him, who's being real, you know, I'm going to be benevolent. I'm not going to hurt you, that kind of thing. And makes him put the pistol in his, you know, puts the barrel of the pistol, as I'm sure you know. But
you should describe it, though, because it's, you're just holding your breath the whole time.
He says, open up, and he puts the barrel of the gun in his mouth, says, now close it. And I actually took my finger and tried to talk, oh, please don't shoot, you know, just to see what it would sound like. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he doesn't shoot him. He sees himself shooting, but he doesn't, and he takes the pistol out. Now, one ending of that story, he watches the guy walk off and finds himself feeling sorry for him, and then he puts the pistol in his own mouth and pulls the trigger. That was the last line of the story for a while.
Oh.
And I read it to some smart students of mine, and one of them, who's has become a good, dear friend, said, you know, man, I don't know, I think, you know, That makes the whole story about his suicide. And then Tom Jenks at Narrative Magazine said pretty much the same thing. And I said, well, let me just go through it again. And then I realized that it's stronger if it occurs to him that may be in his future because his father killed himself, that something's coming toward him that's big, and that, you know, and he's thinking about how he has to go home every night alone and all of that, and then that he feels sorry for the guy who's going away with the stains of having urinated himself in terror with that gun in his mouth. And I thought, yeah, it's a better story that way. And I'm glad for the... Mm-hmm. I don't often give unfinished show unfinished stuff, but I'm glad I did it in this instance. But the violence thing, it's just... To me... We are one of the most violent cultures in the history of the world. We have tens of thousands of deaths every year from violence. And it's gun violence. Every year the number of gun deaths in this country approaches the number of deaths in the whole Vietnam War. And yet there's no marching in the streets. Oh, it's beginning now with those wonderful kids from Parkland. Did you know that this year, you must have seen it too, this year, in 2018, more students and children have died than soldiers?
I was going to mention that statistic, that it's safer to send your kids to war than to school.
Right. I mean, my God. So... You know, every time I drop Lila off at school, I worry about it. I think, no, what, you know, it's so wide open there. Anybody could walk in.
Yeah.
And so I think that just...
And the threshold, I was reading some... Well, this is a different topic.
No, go ahead. No.
I was reading something about Malcolm Gladwell's theory about these school shootings, that the threshold is getting lower and lower. And when it, you know, first began happening, pre-Columbine even, the threshold for a shooter to do it was very high. And with each successive one, the threshold comes down and down and down.
Yeah.
And their motivations are lower. You know, they just don't need to be provoked as much as they used to.
Yeah.
Which is making them more and more prevalent. Yeah, there's right.
And they're going to get their name in the newspaper. They're going to have their picture taken. They're going to be all over the news. I mean, a part of it, I think, has to do with just the fact that fame and infamy have merged and become just, you know, Hitler's a celebrity. So that's all they want to do. They want to be...
Leave their mark.
You want to be on the Hitler channel, yeah.
A desperate form of immortality, I guess.
Yeah.
Your name out.
But notice that it's always a white male. I think it comes from white supremacy. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. The Second Amendment was a concession the founders gave to the southern states so they could keep their slave patrols. In other words, the myth about our history, that the slaves were docilely just sort of slaves. They resisted at every turn. They ran away. They, you know, and they had these slave patrols. And these slaves were unarmed, and many of them died as a result of these slave patrols, the well-regulated militias, so-called. So the Second Amendment... It's not the holy Second Amendment. It is the original sin of this country, and it's playing out in our schools. These people who blindly, without thinking about it and without maybe knowing about it, say, oh, we have the right Second Amendment, the Second Amendment. Well, you know, there were amendments, for instance, to make it so that people couldn't have alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And we repealed it because it wasn't working, and the Second Amendment isn't working. It's a vestige of white supremacy. And the one thing of hope that I have about it is, and it's a strong hope, is that in Montgomery, Alabama, where in 1968 I stood on the Capitol steps and spat at midnight, we were singing down there, this band I was traveling with, that Montgomery, Alabama has opened the first commemoration of the horrible long crime. And we're going to Sewanee. We're going to leave early and visit Alan Wire and his wife in Gunnersville, and we're going to drive to Montgomery and look at that monument, because that's the until we face that crime, and by facing it, I really mean we have to say, for instance, one thing that would address it, and it wouldn't be reparation; it'd be justice. Is just to say that every child of color born in this country is guaranteed a college education at whatever college he or she chooses when they come to college age. And that free. Mm-hmm. And I think we can afford to do that. If we can afford to spend $7.5 billion a year on cat food, we can do that, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't like cats all that much. Sorry.
Yeah. Amazing. You know, I should announce that I'm here with Richard Bausch. I haven't done that for a while. People might not know who I'm talking to.
Who is this guy?
Who is this guy?
Is he running for
who
office?
Who is this brilliant man you get to talk to? You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm so stunned. I was just drowning in your words. I forgot that I was supposed to ask you all these questions. Tell me about Memphis a little bit. So as we're talking about the South and reparations in the South, a lot of these stories are centered around Memphis, and I just would love to hear your relationship with
Memphis. Well, I just love the town. I lived there for 7 years. And in fact, the novel I'm working on now is set in a theater called the Memphis Shakespeare Theater, where these people are all, you know, it's all of these people are attached to this theater, and they're trying to put on King Lear. And they have a visiting director who has some strange ideas about how to put that play on. And Lear is my favorite play of Shakespeare's, although it's tough to pick a favorite. I mean, I love all of Shakespeare. he really is the number one all-time champion. Mm-hmm. There's a moment in Romeo and Juliet where the nurse is talking about when Juliet was a child that absolutely, I am certain, is an autobiographical moment that Shakespeare delivers, because she's talking about how the child has fallen on her face, and the nurse's husband jokes and says, "Thou'lt fall on thy back when thou reachest age." And the two-year-old said, "I." And they laughed so hard, and I know Shakespeare saw that and put it in the play, you know. But God, I would love to meet him. The greatest writer who ever lived. And my daughter Maggie, Maggie and Amanda, both my younger daughters, we were homeschooling. They got into Shakespeare in a big way, and they were doing scenes from him. And one day Maggie, musing in the living room, said, "You know, Dad, Shakespeare's better than everybody who came before him and everybody who came after him." I said, "Yeah, I think you got the right idea, sweetheart." And it was her idea.
The right one. Yeah. Let's talk a bit about, I have a hard time with titles, titling stories. The title of the collection I love, and often the titles come from a story in the book, which was not the case this time. But so many of these are wonderful, and I kind of, when in the process they come to you and how they come to you, is there an insight you can give mortals?
I had terrible trouble with them if I don't have a title while I'm writing the story. In other words, if it doesn't come up while I'm writing the story, then titling it is just a nightmare. I mean, I had 139 titles for my first novel, and it was James Dickey who finally gave me a title, and I didn't like it when he did, you know, I didn't like Real Presence. I'm going, you know, but my editor liked it, and then now I can't imagine that book with another title. That's absolutely the right title for it. So trust a great poet to get it right.
Right.
But if I don't have a title during the writing, if it doesn't come up, and usually if it does, I'll take it out of the story because that's going to be the title. Because although a lot of people, including people like John Updike, will leave it in there, and you'll see this is where the title comes from. But I think it takes you out of the story if you come upon the line and go, "Oh, well, that's what the title."
Feels like you solved a puzzle or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I very rarely will leave it in. I mean, my story, What Feels Like the World, I had the line, and so he leaves the school and drives home and to his life there and what feels like the world. And I went, that's the title. And I crossed it out of the draft and put it in a little circle in the margin. And say, but I love it when that happens, because mm-hmm. then it can help you focus, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there's a title I've had since I was at Iowa, which is now 38 years longer. God, more than 40 years. So I've never been able to find the story for it. And the title is, "I Hope You Continue to Have a Good Time After I Tell You the News." But I can't find the title for it, and I don't know. I mean, I can't find the story for it. So anybody listening out there, you want to write a story with that title, you're welcome to it.
Reminds me of a line my dad always said, "When I die, it's going to be a bad day for everybody." And he was right. That's true. There's a wonderful little, it's almost a flash fiction piece in here about a man who killed a boy driving by accident.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember where it is here. And he visits this museum often. I'd love if you could just talk about that story a little bit, where it came from and kind of how it evolved. It's a very short piece, but it really stayed with me.
Trying to remember the title of that.
So am I. It's the Museum of Something here.
The Museum of the Americas.
Americas, right. Right. It's so short that I can't find it anymore. There it is. Yeah, the Museum of the Americas. In the Museum of the Americas.
And what's the first line? Is that, it's my custom, or it's his?
Yeah, lately, after working or trying to work, he visits the Museum of the Americas. Yeah. He wanders in the South American wing.
Yeah, I used to give students an exercise and say, it is my custom on Fridays to visit the Aztec Museum. And it's not right from that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then one day I thought, well, I wonder, maybe I can write from it, a version of it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I started it not knowing really what I had until pretty far along. I had him wandering around in the museum, and I'm going, why is he here? And then it hit me, oh, wait a minute, he's telling somebody something. And then it began to be a thing where he's made up worlds, and, you know, he's written stories where the last battle for humankind is sort of the central thing and all of that. And now he has to try to do that in this crust world he lives in from having made this, you know, had this terrible thing happen. That he isn't really responsible for, in the sense that it's just a kid running out in the street, but that he feels responsible for because he was distressed and daydreaming when it happened. But I didn't really know how it was going to end or any of that.
Speaking of the psychotherapist, that's who he's talking to in the story, right? He's with a therapist.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. Endings, I think, in short stories are particularly difficult. The short story form, unlike the novel form, endings leave you a little untethered and, you know, uncertain about the future. Really, your own future, is how I felt. Any insights into how you can guide us into finding... When you know... I think a lot of writers overwrite and you know, if they cut the last paragraph or two paragraphs, sometimes that can solve the problem. But short story endings, I think, are tricky. I don't know if you have...
I always feel like... there's a story of mine called What Feels Like... That story, What Feels Like the World, about the little girl that can't get over the vaulting horse. And at the end of the story, her grandfather, she's searching the crowd before she's supposed to be the next one to run up to it. And he has broken his own reserve and the quiet of the audience, saying it's too much to put on a child. Every child has some kind of talent. It's something. Why make her go through this? And then he realizes that he's spoken out of turn. And then, you know, he looks and there she is. She's the next one. And she's searching the crowd. And it says, searching the crowd for him who stands there thinking his heart might break, lifting his hand to wave. And it ends there. And I read it to my wife, and she said, "Oh, you can't end it there. You gotta, you know." And I thought about it, and another friend said, "What are you leaving it there for?" And I thought, "Well, all right, I'm gonna try to, you know." And I went down there and tried to do it, and it absolutely wouldn't give me one more line. And I realized that the story had been told. The story is really not about whether or not this girl can get over the vaulting horse. The story is about the grandfather who comes to the point of actually violating his own sense of civility and politeness by bursting out like that about her. And that the story occurred to me in those terms. You know, I was at a children's fifth grade gymnastics demonstration, and about six kids ran around it because they couldn't get over it. And I had an image of this fellow I used to see walking his daughter into school, this heavyset girl, and he was heavyset, and they so obviously, a beautiful connection between the two, obviously so much loving each other. And his pain walking away from that school with her in there and the doors closed, knowing what kind of torturous stuff she would go through. And I thought of him, then I was him. Running down the hall saying, "What is this about? Can't you, you know," that there would be that sudden sort of a nearly pathological interruption to things. So I thought of that, and then I realized if I have her sail over that vaulting horse, I'm cheating the reader. I'm insulting the reader's intelligence. Obviously, she isn't going to get over it. She's not been able to do it. And if she does, it's triacly sentimentality, the same kind of thing that a movie I had just seen, where at the end, believe me, the stuff at the end was so insulting, I yelled in the theater, "Dad's still dead from suicide and cancer!" because the whole town is transformed by this kid who can fly above the town, and the girl who's dealing with the death of her father from suicide is flying with him, and it's like we're all supposed to go out of there. It's like, as movies like that and stories like that, it seems to me their intent is to put us to sleep like pups.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I'm not going to be able to do that. I won't do that. And then I thought, and if I take it to where she's not getting over it. I'm just rubbing the reader's nose in it, and it's not really about that, you know. So I left it, and, you know, I don't have any regrets about it. And I started thinking it's not really about a happy ending or an unhappy ending. It's about the right ending, where the things that you've set out to express reach some sort of fruition that you may not even be fully aware of. So you get a feeling when you do it, as much as, you know, I've been doing it now for a long time, you get a feeling for it when you're coming to the end. It's almost as if, you know, when you listen to classical music, if you don't know the piece, you can almost always feel it coming to its end because the cadence has become more, I don't know, more stately somehow, you know. Except for Sibelius, who fools us on his Fifth Symphony, where there are these huge... Have you ever heard the end of that thing?
No.
He goes, da, 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 like that. There's like 3 seconds between each one, and you're going, That's brilliant.
It's brilliant. Speaking of happy endings, unhappy endings are just the right ending. We're out of time. Can you believe it?
I know. 5 minutes.
I know.
That's great.
I know.
You do.
It's not great. It's not great because I have 1,000 other things to. I'll just have to have you back on.
You're a great interviewer.
I had such a great time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We'll do it again. That's all the time we have for this week. I will be right back here. No, I won't. Barbara's going to be right back here with you next Wednesday. I'm going to take a week off. And anyway, stay tuned. There's more great programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Have a great, great day.